I'm Tim Padgett.
And I'm Sammy Mack.
Welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. We begin today with a power struggle, both political and electrical. It pits Florida's largest utility against some of South Florida's most affluent communities. This week, Governor Rick Scott approved a plan by Florida Power & Light to build two new nuclear generators on Biscayne Bay at Turkey Point in South Miami-Dade County. But he also okayed 88 miles of transmission lines using towers as high as 150 feet, much of which would run through Miami, Coral Gables, South Miami, and Pinecrest. Most of them have vowed to go to court to block it, and they're angry, not just with the FPL, but with Governor Scott. Here with us to explore this high-voltage controversy is one of Florida's top political journalists, Miami Herald Tallahassee Bureau Chief Mary Ellen Kloss. She joins us from WFSU in the Capitol. Always great to have you with us, Mary Ellen.
Hi, great to be here.
Mary Ellen, this is a dispute that's been years in the making. What's at the heart of it, and why are emotions running so high about it?
Well, this is likely to be the biggest power plant development in 40 years. We have a proposal to put a nuclear... two nuclear reactors, as you mentioned, on Biscayne Bay, and in order to support the power for that, they have to go through a transmission line that goes through some of the most congested and built up and affluent areas of Miami-Dade County.
And as you reported this week, one of the big questions here is why FPL is insisting on nuclear reactors when so many utilities in Florida and around the country are opting for cheaper alternatives like natural gas.
And that's, yes, that's a big question. Now, this was put into the pipeline, or the process began back in 2006 when we had the focus on climate change and the natural gas prices were rising. So since then, they have developed this argument that there was a need, and it was also at the time where there is the building boom in the before the recession. So they identified the need for a nuclear plant, got the approval from the state regulators, and now they are sticking with that proposal.
Well,
now, the transmission line could go ahead even without the nuclear power plant, which is, I think, a huge crux of the argument.
Right. And we put that question to Steve Scroggs, FPL Senior Project Development Director.
The nuclear component provides a balance of fuel diversity within the system so that you're not totally reliant on natural gas. Back in 2004, 2005, we had some hurricanes that went through the Gulf of Mexico, interrupted natural gas supply, and created quite a bit of price volatility. Unfortunately, that's passed on directly to our customers.
And with Japan's Fukushima tragedy still fresh in people's minds, and just as important, sea level rise, as yet another major climate change study reminded us this week, we also asked Mr. Scroggs about the vulnerability of nuclear reactors to disasters like hurricanes.
The nuclear designs are very robust. When Andrew came through, very nearly went over the top of Turkey Point. We know when a hurricane's coming, we can shut the units down and put them in a safe position. It's not like an earthquake. The fuel is always very safely stored in very secure Category 5 strength buildings.
But Mary Ellen, FPL still needs a license from the Federal Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Are they likely to get it?
That is something that's long in coming. I don't know. Right now, there have been many nuclear or many electric companies around the nation that initially began the nuclear regulatory approval in recent years, and many of them have also pulled back on that. After Fukushima, the cost of developing these nuclear generators and the technology has come into question. The costs have risen dramatically. Duke Power, formerly Progress Florida, had initially planned to build a nuclear power plant in Levy County in Florida, and right. has pulled that away. So whether they get it or not, I think, is a big question.
But beyond the regulatory concerns lies a potentially long legal fight. Miami City Attorney Victoria Mendez this week guaranteed a court challenge. So did local leaders like South Miami Mayor Philip Stoddard, who joins us now by Skype. Thanks for talking with us, Mayor Stoddard.
Oh, good afternoon.
Why do South Miami and so many other municipalities object to this plan?
Oh, boy. There are so many reasons to be concerned about this plan. We've got issues of nuclear economics. We've got issues of nuclear location. We've have issues of nuclear safety. We've got issues of transmission lines having to do with their economic consequences and with their safety issues. And the limitations they put on other types of development along the one of the most economically productive corridors in South Florida. Where do you want to begin?
Well, here, first, let's listen to what Steve Scrogg's response FPL's response is to the economic impact complaints that you mentioned.
The judge listened to opposition witnesses and FPL witnesses and basically determined that there would be minimal impact on property values along an already heavily commercial and industrial corridor with a number of other linear facilities such as the Metro Rail. A lot of US 1 does have existing transmission lines on it right now.
Mayor Stoddard, is FPL underestimating the effect on property values? And what about his argument that the Dixie Highway Corridor has power lines in the Metro Rail already?
Well, let's take this apart. First of all, FPL hired a consultant out of Leon County, Tallahassee area, to come down and shoot holes in the very careful studies that had been done by University of Miami economist Richard Weisskopf. And the guy says Weisskopf, their so-called expert said that Weisskopf made a mistake. In fact, their expert made a mistake. Their expert misquoted Weisskopf, failed to note the issues with Weisskopf's study that Weisskopf had pointed out, and characterized the entire US 1 corridor's economy as a mobile filling station where somebody pulls in to get gas and Slim Jims.
And we know
that the US 1 corridor is home to a lot of residential properties. We know it's got high-end economic. You don't find used car dealerships. You find Cadillac dealerships, Porsche dealerships, Lexus dealerships, very high economic activity. So I think that their expert was simply wrong and was just hired to do a drive-by assassination.
And just going back a second, why had there been 8 weeks of hearings? What had led to that point?
Well, one of the requirements is that hearings are conducted. And so they brought in an administrative law judge who, quite frankly, let everybody speak. He was very good in that regards, but it did not appear that he was really interested in entertaining both sides of the argument. Every time he made a decision, it was in FPL's favor. He dismissed very credible witnesses for reasons that I don't think were credible. I mean, I think it was the most biased set of opinions I've ever seen.
Mayor, your neighbor Coral Gables did come to an agreement with FPL about limiting the size of the transmission poles placed there. Do you plan to seek a similar settlement?
No, I don't. And I don't, my view of this is that the height of the transmission lines and the poles is not determined by any kind of settlement that a municipality could reach. It's determined by the needs for safety under the Siting Act. You have to have the poles and lines elevated to the level where you can maintain 15 microteslas magnetic field strength on the edge of the right-of-way. And that's not determined by a legal agreement. That's determined by physics.
Right. You've also argued that FPL should install these transmission lines underground. FPL has said, great, if you're willing to pay for it. Could you and FPL, for example, come up with some cost-sharing settlement for underground transmission?
Well, I mean, you have to look at who is bearing the economic brunt of the transmission lines. The municipalities are bearing the full brunt. Furthermore, FPL used to run transmission lines underground through the city of Miami. They still do. So what's changed? Why has FPL decided that they should no longer run transmission lines underground through areas of high residential density and economic activity? It's purely a profit motive here. And, you know, FPL is returning vast return to their shareholders. You all described these as the most affluent communities in the area. South Miami is not. We have some of the well-to-do people, but we also have one of the poorest communities.
And we actually have a call right now from Barry and Kendall, who's with a group that is all about safe energy and opposes Turkey Point. Barry, you're on the air. What is your concern about this?
Well, how much time do you have?
Well, what's your top concern?
First of all, there's an alternate route that exists up 97th Avenue that is there, it's cleared. All they have to do, based on what they said they want to increase that route by 1/6, and they'll get the energy they need. It comes right over the falls, by the falls, it goes up, down, and then they can go downtown. There's no need to build a whole new route up US 1, except if they want to move power to Georgia and beyond.
And that's Mayor Stoddard, when you hear that, is that something that you had proposed?
Yes, it is something we'd proposed, and Mr. White is absolutely correct. If I may, I'd like to steer the conversation over to the nuclear economics. I mean, I think we've talked the issue of the lines quite a lot, but the nuclear power is the most expensive form of power you can produce. And so what we're not hearing is that the current estimates on the cost for building these two nuclear plants is about $24 billion. It's risen between three and four times since the determination of need was approved in 2008. Meanwhile, the cost of natural gas, as Mary Ellen Klass pointed out, has dropped by about two-thirds. The cost of solar has dropped more than 50% and continues to drop. And so the economics have reversed.
Right.
For the same amount of money that they can build these two nuclear plants to serve 750,000 customers, electricity, they can put in solar to serve a million.
Right.
And that number is going to increase. So there's another issue as well, and that
right.
is when.
All right. But Mayor Stoddard, in terms of the battle at hand, Mary Ellen, what are the specific grounds that these local governments like South Miami have for suing FPL over this issue?
Actually, I think we should ask the mayor that, because right now it seems to me that they're going to be challenging the findings of the administrative law judge. One of the things that the cities asked the governor and cabinet to do was consider the fact that the administrative law judge misinterpreted state law as it applies to zoning and other development laws that where the city and county mm-hmm. should have a role in having those laws take precedence over FPL's interpretation.
Right.
I'm not explaining this well, but...
Right. But in the broader picture, Mary Ellen, it seems another big complaint here is an allegedly long history of not just Rick Scott, but Florida state government generally rolling over for FPL. You point out in your article this week that the FPL has contributed millions to the state Republican Party and the governor's campaign. How worried are watchdogs about this relationship?
You know, I think that if you ask any legislator or anyone on the cabinet and the governor, which I did, they all say that they cannot be bought. Their vote cannot be bought.
All right. Mayor Stoddard, I'll give you the last word on this. Do you and local governments like South Miami in this regard feel outgunned?
Well, we feel that the process was slanted against us. I think we do feel that we have some merit for a case to the third DCA for lack of due process. We are quite confident that the determination of need is out of date and needs to be updated if we can get the PCA to listen.
Right.
And we wonder whether the NRC is actually going to approve this. We suspect they're not.
We'll have to leave it at that. South Miami Mayor Philip Stoddard and Mary Ellen Kloss, Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald, thank you both. Coming up, we look at Medicare fraud and the legacy today of Brown versus Board of Education. Stay with us. This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN.
Hello and welcome back. I'm Sammy Mack.
I'm Tim Padgett.
And you're listening to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Our guests today are Jody Tillman of the Tampa Bay Times. She's joining us from St. Petersburg. And David Smiley of the Miami Herald is here in studio with us. We also want to hear from you. Your questions are welcome for the panel. You can call us at 1-800-743-WLRN. That's 1-800-743-9576. You can also tweet us at the call sign at WLRN and join the conversation online, WLRN.org, where we've got a conversation going. You can check that out. It's on the homepage. So turning now to Medicare, a ProPublica investigation out this week looked at how doctors bill Medicare for office visits. And when a Medicare patient comes into an office visit, the doctor bills for that interaction on a scale of 1 to 5, 1 being a pretty easy, simple visit, and a 5 represents a much more complex, lengthy visit. And there are some anomalies in Florida. Jody Tillman with the Tampa Bay Times, you've worked on the story in collaboration with ProPublica. What did you find in Florida?
Yeah, we found there were about 160 providers who billed more than 90% of their office visits at that highest level. Another 425 billed at least half their office visits at that level. Those numbers alone may not mean much, but what you have to do is look at as a whole, how do their specialties bill? And actually, overall, most visits for all physicians across the board are less than 5% at that highest level. So these are outliers.
And just how much more money are we talking about when somebody bills at a level 5 versus a level 3, which I understand is much more common?
Yeah, it varies, but level 5 can be over $100 per visit, whereas the more typical level 3 is about half that, a little over 50.
And why does this matter to patients, whether or not their doctors are billing at the max versus kind of the average?
Sure. Well, for one thing, you want to make sure that if your doctor's saying that your visit was that complex, he may have spent quite a bit of time with you, that actually is reflected in the billing. Did that actually happen? This is kind of a hard story to sometimes get across to people, because most people say, well, gosh, I'd love to spend more time with my doctor. You have to look at what's actually happening here, what kind of the complexity of your illness, how complex the treatment is, that kind of thing. And if you owe a copay too, you're going to have or coinsurance, you're going to have a higher bill than if you were billed at a lower visit.
And you actually spoke to some of these doctors who charge at the level 5 rate at an extraordinarily high amount of times for their office visits. Tell us about Dr. Matthew Edlund.
Yeah, sure. He's a psychiatrist in Sarasota, and he billed that year in 2012, which is what this data looks at. He billed 100% of his established patient visits at that highest level. And what he said, and what I also heard from other doctors I talked to about the story is, hey, we've got some very complicated patients. Nobody comes in here with a head cold and gets a level 5. These are people I'm having to make multiple decisions on. I'm spending a lot of time with them. It's worth taking all that with a grain of salt. You have to look at how their peers are also billing. And again, we're talking about all Medicare patients, so these are all seniors.
Yeah, and I actually spoke with Cindy Weston, she's the head of the American Medical Billing Association, which is an organization that all they do is they're very dedicated to billing, and she's very intimate with this. And she had this reaction.
I find that kind of shocking. If it's family practitioners, pediatrics, general practitioners, it's kind of shocking that they're billing 100%. They see everybody from hangnail to heart attack.
Everybody from hangnail to heart attack. She also pointed out that these people would be ripe for an audit and potentially an investigation looking into fraud. And this comes on the heels of a huge Medicare fraud bust this week. Mm-hmm. We had 50 suspects from South Florida who were nabbed by a Medicare fraud task force. They allegedly tried to steal nearly $66 million out of Medicare. How do these weird billing patterns square with Florida's history of Medicare fraud?
Well, in some ways, Florida, we're talking about 160 docs who are billing 90% to 100%. That doesn't not, I mean, I just want to be careful. That doesn't necessarily mean we're talking about fraud. It does raise the potential for some red flags. Medicare has had this data, and they just haven't, for whatever reason, haven't looked at it in this sort of systematic way that ProPublica did.
I'm wondering, how does this change the way that you think about your interactions with your own doctors?
Me personally? Yeah, I mean, you start kind of thinking about, like, how much time are you really spending with your doctor? Sure, yeah.
And if listeners were interested to know if their doctors are one of these outliers or not, how can you find out what kind of billing patterns they have?
Yeah, ProPublica actually developed a really pretty good little app that you can look up your doctor by name, by city, and we've got that on our website. They also have it on their website. I think it's called Treatment Tracker, something like that.
Yeah, and I believe we've also posted it on our website.
Okay.
Yeah, WLRN.org. All right, so Jody Tillman, thank you so much for joining us. Jody Tillman is with the Tampa Bay Times, and she joined us from St. Petersburg, Florida. Thanks, Jody.
Thanks, Amy.
And you are listening to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. Again, you can join the conversation. Call us at 1-800-743-WLRN or find us on Twitter at WLRN. And joining us now is David Smiley, the education reporter for the Miami Herald. This Saturday marks the 60th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. That's the Supreme Court decision that wrote the opinion declaring separate is inherently unequal. The process of desegregation took decades, but Miami-Dade County was actually a leader in the state early on. David, you've been working on some stories around this milestone. What are some of the themes that you've been hearing as people look back on their memories of desegregation?
Well, I think most people remember the process pretty fondly, and perhaps that has a lot to do with time passing. But the stories that we hear about integration and desegregation are generally stories about teachers maybe standing up for the first white teacher in an all-black school, students making friends with the first white student at a largely black school, or vice versa. I sat down with Gary Range, one of the first students to attend an integrated school in Florida, who in 1959 went to Orchard Villa Elementary in Liberty City, which at the time was an all-white school. And he, you know, he remembers pretty fondly about going into the school and sort of the chaos outside, and yet how calm it was inside, and how sort of easy it was to, for the first time, attend a class full of white students.
And Orchard Villa was actually, I think, the first school in Florida to integrate, right?
Right, the first school in Florida, yes.
Yeah, and we have sound from one of the people that we've interviewed. This is a memory from Mamie Pinder. She was a first-time classroom teacher at the previously all-white Alapata Elementary School. And she's talking about a fourth grader named Willie Finch. And just to note, there is some strong language in here.
I always remember Finch, because Finch was the only one who called me an old black negro, nigger. I said, you know what? I got to do better. I started saying in the lunchroom, who want my milk? Or who want my sandwich? You know, Finch got at least half of the time, gave him more. And he loved me more. When it was time for him to leave, he cried like a baby.
What do you hear when you hear that story?
I mean, that's a woman who is very proud of her experience of being able to, you know, when she talked about Finch, she talked about a kid who started off seeing her as someone who, you know, sort of the enemy, and by the end, you know, he was very close to her. And that's actually a pretty typical story you hear in terms of teachers and students who went through integration.
David, as a parent who's putting two kids through Miami-Dade Public Schools, and someone whose wife is a Miami-Dade Public Schools teacher, I'm curious what you think is the legacy, and also how well integration is playing out in Miami today. You often hear, you know, some rumblings that perhaps, you know, we've created pockets in the county where things are still a little too segregated.
Yeah, if you look at a map of the schools in Miami-Dade County, and you take a look at the schools that fit the definition of a segregated school under the courts, which was 85% black. Or one minority race. There are still pockets throughout Miami-Dade, in the inner city for black schools, in the northwest and west for Hispanic schools, where to a large extent these schools are still sort of racially isolated. And there are, you know, there are black activists, teachers, the NAACP, they remain pretty concerned about it. Earlier this week, Robert Runcie, the superintendent with Broward Schools, made a comment during an NAACP conference that sometimes you look around and it's almost as if Brown had never happened. But I think that to a large extent is looking, when you look specifically at race, where researchers also, I think these days, want to look not just at race but also poverty. And the correlation between those tends to be a little bit different with Hispanic schools down here, which just because you're a largely Hispanic school doesn't necessarily mean you're also a poor school or a low-performing academic school, where those rates tend to vary from school to school. For the inner-city Black schools, it's a little more concentrated. Those largely are poor schools and schools that are struggling academically. Not all of them. Miami Norland's a school where 90% is Black, and yet the graduation rate is 85%, which is much larger or much greater than the typical Black graduation rate around the state. So the outcome is a little bit different.
Yeah, and listeners, we are really interested to hear from you how diverse or segregated you feel your school is. Feel free to give us a call at 1-800-743-WLRN. Again, that's 1-800-743-9576, and tell us about how you experience diversity or segregation in your classes today. I understand you have been actually working on a map of these that we'll be able to see hopefully soon on the Miami Herald website.
Right, yeah.
And when you were doing the research into the sort of demographics of the schools as they are now, what did the district say about it?
Well, the district, I think they look at the situation in terms of opportunity and choice, where, I mean, in part, the courts have sort of limited what school systems can do with diversity programs in terms of using race to begin with. So now it's more about income level in geography as opposed to individual students' race.
Yeah, but along those lines, David, is the district doing enough then in terms of devices that are available to us in terms of things like magnet schools, which seem to be robust on the secondary school level, but not so much so on the primary school level?
If you look at just the number of choice seats compared to the number of seats in the district, there are 100,000 students in charter schools and magnet schools compared to 350,000 students in the entire district. So that's almost one choice seat for every three students, which is a pretty significant number. If you look at the terms of, again, looking at isolated schools, there are more elementary schools where the younger you get, I think the more likely kids are to go to their neighborhood school. So that certainly, I think, is a valid issue. Also, the academics tend to correlate more closely to elementary schools than high schools and middle schools. So, there are a lot of folks who are calling on the district to do more. I know in my conversations with Miami-Dade schools, they feel like any student in any school has the opportunity to get the type of education that they choose to have.
So. And I'm curious, when you hear about schools that are almost entirely white or Black or Hispanic, how is that legal at this point?
Well, Miami-Dade Schools hasn't been under court order for desegregation since 2001. So there's no one looking over their shoulder to say what schools' makeup should or shouldn't be any longer. In 2001, a federal judge declared that sort of the vestiges of a segregated system had been eradicated. Under the law's eyes, Miami-Dade Schools are it's an integrated system with no issues. Activists may not entirely agree, but in the eyes of the law, they've done what they had to do.
And in that vein, we heard this week again about a group that is petitioning against the state, which has different math and reading goals for different students based on race and also disability. For example, in the state, part of the five-year plan, which was released a couple of years ago, says, they expect by, I think it's 2017-2018 school year, that 92% of Asians will pass their math tests, 80% of Hispanics will, and 74% of Black students will. And a couple of organizations filed a civil rights complaint against this. And so far, there hasn't been a lot of movement. But what does that tell you about where we are in terms of what we expect of kids based on their race?
Yeah, I think a lot of people around the country looked at what Florida did with those race-based goals and kind of shook their heads. Other states didn't handle it quite the same. Locally, our school's officials sort of, you know, were among that group saying, you know, questioning why Florida would set those goals out to be that way. But I think, you know, in those numbers, whether Florida should or should not have done that, I think you're seeing sort of a nod to the fact that there still is this achievement gap that is undeniable between minority students and white students, and that there still is a lot of progress that needs to be made in terms of bridging that gap.
And we've got a call from Michelle in Hollywood. Michelle, I understand you are a teacher at a school.
Oh, I'm not a teacher, but I just wanted to make a comment quickly. My kids went to Virginia Schumann Young. It's a magnet Montessori school, and I'm wondering if the host is familiar with that school. But when it started as a magnet many years ago, it was mostly low socioeconomic, and it was not very diverse. But because of the Montessori magnet and having a wonderful principal, wonderful teachers, the school became very diverse and very integrated on every level, and it's a wonderful, wonderful school.
What do we know about how magnets can impact diversity in a school?
Well, it's tough to know for every magnet program because Miami-Dade schools don't keep enrollment data for every specific program. But if you look at the schools that are entirely magnet or mega magnets, they might call them, they do tend to be quite diverse, even in a district where less than 10% of students are white. And typically people look at diversity in terms of exposure from minority students to white students. And magnet schools and charter schools do tend to be more diverse in that vein. I think one of the things that you do hear concerns about with schools of choice is that as they become more diverse, are their demographics disproportionate to the school district's demographics? So in Miami-Dade, where you see low rates of black students attending charter schools, the question then is that making sort of home schools and traditional schools, is that creating more isolated black schools?
David Smiley, education reporter for the Miami Herald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And still to come, from Christopher Columbus to Michelle Martelly, we get the latest news from Haiti. Stay with us.
I'm Tim Padgett.
And I'm Sammy Mack.
Welcome back to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. So have they found the ship that found the new world? So often the news from Haiti is not good, but this week Haiti was the site of one of the coolest stories we've heard in a while, if it turns out to be true. I'm talking about the possible discovery of the wreck of the Santa Maria, the ship that Christopher Columbus was aboard when he arrived in the Americas in 1492. Joining us to talk about this potentially blockbuster find is Jacqueline Charles, who covers the Caribbean for the Miami Herald. Jackie, great to have you on again.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about what veteran underwater explorer Barry Clifford claims he's located off Haiti's north coast.
Well, Barry Clifford is certain, as he told me, that he has found the wreckage from Christopher Columbus's Santa Maria ship. What he described, for instance, is that 10 years ago, they found some cannons
right there,
you know, encrusted in corals. At the time, they did not know what exactly they had, the gold mine, so to speak. Mm-hmm. They took photographs, and then just recently, he came across the file that his son had filed away with the photographs, looked at them again, and suddenly realized that these cannons are what Christopher Columbus had described, or what historians have said, were on the Santa Maria.
And we should mention that he was using very somewhat detailed, at least for the 15th century, detailed historical records of where the ship went down, where it went aground on Christmas Eve, 1492.
Well, and that's also part of the controversy, because I spoke to a skeptic, another underwater explorer.
And there are many about this, yeah.
And many of them who, over the years, thought that they also had found the Santa Maria. And this gentleman had worked with the University of Florida excavation team. He'd done some archaeology studies in northern Haiti. And he basically says that where Barry Clifford is saying Christopher Columbus had built the Fort Navidad with the timbers from the Santa Maria, mm-hmm. that they had excavated that site. They did not find that fort. But according to Barry Clifford, they found the wreckage exactly 4.7 miles as Christopher Columbus described in his journal or his logbooks, from the fort. So I've got some investigations to do.
As do we all. And as does a gentleman named Professor Charles Beaker. The job of verifying Clifford's find now falls on Professor Beaker, who directs Indiana University's underwater science program. Jackie, you and I both talked to Beaker this week, and here's what he told me when I asked him just how important this discovery is if it does turn out to be the Santa Maria.
An alien spaceship today landing in the North America would be equivalent to the Santa Maria coming to the New World. This is the first permanent contact between European and the indigenous peoples.
That was Beaker speaking to me from the Dominican Republic. Jackie, how important would you rate it if it turns out to be true? And also, what sort of tourism boost could this give Haiti if it's true?
Well, I have to tell you, it would be a huge tourism boost. But, you know, it's interesting because Haitians in the north of Haiti have always felt that they had found the Santa Maria. But I think for a country that's now trying to get tourists to come back and is trying to raise its profile, this would be really huge. And there's a lot that they can do with it. And also, Barry Clifford wants to do a lot with it. He wants this to be a traveling exhibit. He wants to have Haiti remain attached to it and have it be a draw for people to go to the country and for people to learn more about Haiti.
Well, as I said, it still needs to be verified, but I think we're all crossing our fingers that it does turn out to be valid. Jackie, there are some more troubling matters to discuss about Haiti as well, starting with fairly startling reports about a new mosquito-borne illness called the chikungunya virus. In just a week or so, the number of cases there seems to have jumped from 15 to about 1,500. How worrisome is this?
Well, I have to tell you, I've been in conversation with a number of people in Haiti, and first of all, they're telling me that they feel even the 1,500 number is underrepresented. That yesterday I'm talking to this young woman who tells me that her mother had it, her sister had it, 10 of her employees had it, and then in the process of our conversation, her boyfriend came by and told her that he got it. So it's very worrisome. When you think about Haiti right now, we went from a drought to every night, practically, it's raining. So you have sitting water, which is a breeding ground for mosquitoes. This mosquito is very common. It bites during the day, during the night. There's, you know, it's unlike other mosquitoes that have certain time from dusk to dawn.
And the symptoms of the chikungunya virus?
Well, the symptoms of that arthritis-like. So imagine just joint pain. So for some people who are fortunate enough, it goes away after a couple of days with a very severe fever you get with it. But then for other people, what we've seen in the French Islands is that it can last for years. South Africa also had this problem. So when you imagine Haiti, a country where it's a very mobile population, where people do a lot of hard labor, walking. So if you imagine a population where you have a lot of people with joint pain, and this is something that can go on for years, this is a huge, potentially a huge economic impact in this country.
And we're seeing evidence that it's also spreading beyond Haiti to the rest of the Caribbean, no?
Right now, it's in about 16 countries, including French Guiana. So Haiti is about the 16th country right now. This is being considered an epidemic in the Caribbean. It is not in Jamaica or Trinidad, as we know, but the rains are expected to start soon in Trinidad, and it could be there.
What if anything can be done to prevent this?
You need a lot of off. But mosquito repellent with DEET is very good. Long sleeves. You know, this virus has been around since the 1950s. It's been to Asia and Africa, but they do not have any sort of vaccination that you can take. And I think that that's what's adding to the paranoia and the concerns that, you know, mosquitoes are prevalent in this part of the world. Just yesterday, this PAHO, the World Health Organization, was meeting with health officials from Central America, preparing them to be on the alert, you know, for this, because people travel and it is not yet in Central America, but they expect for it to be there.
And this is a place that has battled other mosquito-borne illnesses like dengue and malaria in the past. How successful have they been at trying to quell mosquito-borne illnesses in the past?
Well, the Caribbean in general, we have not been very good in the Caribbean in terms of fighting mosquitoes. I mean, it, you know, just from flogging, from, you know, pesticides, just all of these proactive things that you need to do. This is an ongoing battle, you know, for the Caribbean region. But I think with Haiti, when you look at the conditions on the ground, you look at the water, you look at the trash, you look at the gutters. I mean, the government has been making progress in that area, but it's still a concern, and you just have a recipe that's just ripe for this kind of mosquito-borne illness.
And this on top of the cholera epidemic that, that Haiti is also dealing with. From the medical to the political, Jackie, Haitian President Michel Martelly's third anniversary in office this week was marked by anti-government protests. Here's one of the protesters in Port-au-Prince.
The Martelly government will celebrate 3 years of corruption. He keeps the population hostage in misery.
So, Jackie, what's really prompting these latest street demonstrations?
Well, I think the same thing that was prompting the ones a year ago, 2 years ago, and 3 years ago. I mean, you have, on the one hand, a government that is saying that we have the most innovative social program there is in the country, and they've touted their horns on a number of areas. But at the end of the day, the local currency is devaluing quickly. Jobs have not increased. Food prices are still high. And so for the average Haitian, they really are not feeling that progress. It's not starting to trickle down. I mean, this government has been very good on, you know, what some call propaganda, but they've been very good in communications. But at the same time, we still have elections that are 3 years delayed.
Right.
We've seen some investment, but it's basically been in hotels. And the question today for Haiti is sustainability. All of the things that you're seeing that people are oohing and aahing about, the question is, if you get one bad storm, one bad disaster, how will it hold up? And at the end of the day, in a few years from now, are we building a foundation, or is this just sort of more of the or of the same?
Now, the elections, the parliamentary elections that should have been held 3 years ago at about the time that Martelly took office, he has really been dragging his feet to the furor of a lot of U.S. politicians, for example. What can the U.S. do to get Martelly and his government to, they claim that they now have an agreement in place that will allow the elections to be held in October, but nobody's holding their breath. What can be done to start leveraging this government to hold these elections in a more serious fashion?
Well, what's interesting is that for most of the 3 years, President Martelly and his government did not want to hold elections or were not making much progress. So today they were saying, we need elections now. And suddenly the United States, the OAS and the UN are all saying bravo, and they're basically saying, bad on you, opposition, bad on you, senators. But the issues are still there. I mean, for instance, there's the issue about the Electoral Council, which is about putting credibility in the vote. And you have some that are saying, let's just move forward and we'll fix it as we go along. And you have a group of senators that are saying, no, we need to address this issue of credibility.
Right.
And just last week, you saw that Martelly put as the president of this, the lawyer for Jean-Claude Duvalier. And that has just created another wrinkle into this situation.
Well, this week, Martelly's prime minister, Laurent Lamothe, penned an op-ed in your newspaper, the Miami Herald. And I think for those of us who have been watching this issue, some of the claims he makes might sound a tad disingenuous. For example, he says, our principal objective has been to move Haiti's democracy toward firmer footing. And then he says, our progress is being held hostage by the intransigence of a few politicians who, unfortunately, are tied to the turmoil and chaos of the past. How do you rate that, the claims he's making there?
Well, I'm glad you used that word, because when I saw that, that was the first word that also came to my mind. It's sort of, you know, historical amnesia. You know, for people who don't follow it closely, it sounds like the government really wants to move forward. And indeed, it is a few that's holding it hostage. But for those of us who have been following this very closely, we know that it's not that cut and dry. And I do think that today, yes, they want to move it forward, but they are not willing to negotiate and willing to give. And this historical agreement that everybody, including our own representatives here in the United States, keep touting, but they fail to mention that the major political parties in Haiti are not part of this agreement. So when the major political parties have removed themselves and find a problem, are we not just putting a Band-Aid on, you know, the real issues?
Well, we'll have to leave it there. Jackie Charles of the Miami Herald, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
This is the Florida Roundup on WLRN.
And now we remember novelist David Kaufelt. He died this past week at the age of 74. Kaufelt was the founder of the Key West Literary Seminar. If you don't know what that is, it's a really remarkable annual four-day event which draws heavyweight writers like Calvin Treelin and Margaret Atwood to give readings and speak about their work in Key West. Here's Kaufelt in a 1990 radio interview talking about the effect of Key West on the creative mind.
Freud said that we are at our most creative when we're in our very early youth, before we're 5 years old. And that's where we are here. We wear shorts, we ride bicycles, we're surrounded by pirates. They're cocaine pirates, but they're still pirates. We have the water, it's a great symbol of the unconscious. And we're free to be children here and let our spirits go. There's nobody in suits and ties telling us what we have to do or making us feel guilty.
Alicia Zuckerman joining us now, our editorial director and arts editor. Alicia, how did Kaufelt start this seminar?
You know, he moved down to Key West in 1974 from New York. He and his wife came down. He had been, he was a writer, novelist. He had some success with a novel called 6 Months with an Older Woman, which is a title I think is so great.
It's fantastic.
It was made into a TV movie. So he was coming off of the success of that, and he just decided he wanted to just, you know, live his life in Key West. He wanted a totally different life. He wanted to be in the sun and have a more relaxed atmosphere, sort of like live in a more relaxed atmosphere. But he still really wanted to be surrounded by writers. And of course, there's a long literary history in Key West, and there were several living writers who were already there, but he wanted more of them to at least come down for part of the year, at least see Key West as a destination for living writers, breathing writers, people who were making work, you know, alongside Kaufelt. And so he went to some of the publishers in New York City, you know, some of his old contacts, and said, hey, you know, let's set up something here with the library system and get them to come down and do a lecture series. And the story that Arlo Haskell, who's now the associate director of the Key West Literary Seminar, tells is that those publishers told David, nobody in Florida even reads, and they certainly don't buy books. So basically, what's the point, right? And he said, okay, forget it. There are enough of us writers living here in Key West. We can do this ourselves. We don't need New York. We don't need the publishers, you know, and their attitude. And he set it up there in Key West with the writers who were already there.
And so he went around the publishers.
He went around the publishers. And it's such a Key West story. I mean, he sort of went rogue. He went out on his own, and he did this himself with some of the other writers who were there and already. And it really, obviously, it really worked. I mean, that was more than 30 years ago, and it became a huge draw. You mentioned Calvin Trillin and I think Margaret Atwood, also Amy Tan and Derek Walcott, Gillian Flynn from Gone Girl, her book Gone Girl, which I think is about to become a movie or just became a movie, Alexander McCall Smith from Number One Ladies Detective Agency. All of those people and many, many more have come down, and they do this really interesting thing every January where they focus on just a theme. So one year it might be food writing. One year it was literature and the AIDS of AIDS. But the point is that he really did make Key West into the literary destination that he dreamed it would be.
And I'm wondering, okay, so there's these 4 days where people come down and have this really magical, tropical Key West experience. But how has the seminar impacted the writing culture in Key West the rest of the year?
You know, it's a place, one of the things in the obituary that our reporter Mark Hedden did earlier this week, he interviewed Arlo Haskell from the literary seminar. And one of the things Arlo said is that it became a place that people kind of associate with literature. It's a place where writing happens, where literature happens, where reading of literature happens. But also, and I love this because Key West is so small, it's really a tiny island, actually. It's a place where you bump into writers all the time. Like you rub elbows, you're at a cafe and you're sitting next to a writer who may well be a very famous writer, and you could easily strike up a conversation with them because of the very laid-back atmosphere that Key West is, as we heard in the tape earlier in the segment.
Ultimately, what do you think Kaufelt's legacy is?
Oh, it is definitely Key West Literary Seminar and Key West as a place for living writers. And that was one of the points that was really important for Mark, our reporter, to make, that Key West is not just the legacy of Ernest Hemingway.
Next year will be the first seminar that Kaufelt has not attended in 30 years. And that'll do it for the Florida Roundup for Friday, May 16th, 2014. If you missed any of today's show, you can listen to it again on these airwaves tomorrow morning at 6 a.m., or we'll post it on our website, WLRN.org. The Florida Roundup is produced by Elaine Chen and Alicia Zuckerman. Public Insight Network analyst is Steph Farrow. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Executive producer for WLRN is Peter J. Mertz. And thanks very much to our technical supervisor, Paul Leary. South Florida Arts Beat is next with a live performance by Afro-Cuban band Paulo. Don't miss it. It's going to be really fun. I'm Sammy Mack.
And I'm Tim Padgett.
And thanks for listening.